So sitting here with all the candles lit in the dark reminded me of what it was like, what it is still like some places in Asia, when a body of practitioners, monks and nuns, lay people, would gather at a temple or meditation center, or and some often would sit outdoors, and they would sit to meditate, to hear Dharma talks, to have Dharma discussions. And before they had electricity, or places they don't have electricity, and people would sit around with little lamps, little oil lamps or candles, I suppose, and you'd have a sea of little lamps. And these people sitting very peacefully and quietly in that stillness and that quiet. And there's a very different quality, I think, in a space, in a room, when it's dark and these kind of candles happening. I'm reminded that the Buddha seemingly was not very interested in metaphysics. And often his biggest interest in metaphysics was to show how metaphysical speculations or theories were not helpful for the process of becoming liberated, of awakening. And a little bit different how most people maybe approach spiritual liberation. They think they first have to understand some metaphysical truth. And I'm reminded of that now because of the palpable sense of maybe stillness, of quiet, the sense of the contrast of light and dark are not metaphysical experiences, but lend themselves to not metaphysical beliefs or ideas, but lend themselves to a certain kind of experience, a certain kind of reverence or awe or quiet or contemplative kind of environment. About a week or so ago, my son's kindergarten had what I thought was kind of a remarkable little ceremony. It was Sunday evening, so we had to make a special trip to the school. They tried to get the kids to all dress up nicely. Some kids did. Our son put on his sweatshirt. But we were able to come there. We were supposed to have a kind of quiet afternoon before coming to the school. So we came. The kids were supposed to come kind of settled and quiet. And then we went into his classroom, and all the lights were out. And on a table in the middle of the classroom were four candles that were lit. There was only light in the room. And around the table were all the little chairs, kindergarten chairs. And all these kids just went in there, and they took the little chairs and sat down. And all the parents stood behind them in a circle around them. And we were waiting for people still to come, so the kids who came early had you sit there, and everybody was quiet. And my four-year-old son, he's almost five, sat completely still for 10 minutes. He didn't say anything. He didn't budge. He didn't kind of get restless. He just sat very still, very quiet in this very powerful contemplative space that had been created, a quiet space. And at some point, the kindergarten teacher said, okay, let's go. And each kid was given an apple with a candle in it. And it was not lit yet. And then we all had to walk two by two with a parent with a child into this other classroom that had been set up that was also more or less dark. And there was chairs all the way around the perimeter of the room, about this size here, the room. And we were all instructed to kind of sit in that room. We hadn't really talked much at all. It was all quiet. We sat around this big circle. And on the floor, there were these pine branches. They were arranged as a spiral pathway going into the very center. In the very center of it was a kind of a stand where there was one candle standing that was lit. Then some person started playing very softly guitar music. And the four kindergarten teachers of that school were all sitting there kind of in their regal majesty, kind of holding court, kind of just kind of watching very quietly, kind of very beautiful, reverent feeling. And then I think they started with the oldest kid. And he came up with his candle and in the apple. And he had to walk this spiral in front of everybody, in this quiet, very silent, contemplative feeling. He had to walk this whole spiral all the way in to the middle and then light his or her candle. And then walk out of the spiral. And anywhere the child wanted to, someplace upon leaving, going out, put his or her candle down on the floor next to the pine branches. And then to come back and take their seat. And so they did it. I mean, 12 kids did this. And then all 12 kids had done it. Then the instructions was just please come outside. And the teacher gathered all the candles and handed it to the kids outside. We stood looking at the stars. And we sang a song about... then we sang a song about something like... what if all the people lived their lives as if it was a song to sing out light? Something like, anybody know this song? Sing out light to providing the stars with fuel to circle round and round. Something like that. It was kind of a beautiful song. And then we were supposed to go. That was it. Almost no talking had happened. Virtually none at all. And I don't know, maybe this is boring for you to tell you the story. But it was a very strong reverent feeling. It was quite phenomenal to watch each, I was riveted, to watch each of these kindergarten kids by themselves in front of all these people walk up in their own way to light their candle and put their candle down. And you got to kind of, because each kid was doing exactly the same kind of thing. You could see how different they were. It kind of highlighted the differences. You really got a sense, you got a feeling, kind of saw into the depth of that particular child's way of bearing him or herself in the world, and their enthusiasm or confidence or lack of it, or joy or hesitation, or just all these different things were playing out, you know, in the kids. And it felt like this reverent kind of attitude and feeling, this candle ceremony. Had a big impact on my son. I felt like it was kind of, I don't know. So then I told my kindergarten teacher last Friday that I was going to give a talk on bowing. And because I was going to give it yesterday, I gave a talk. Because last Monday, some of you were here, I gave a talk on bowing. And there were some questions about bowing that stimulated me to further thought about it. So I started looking into it. And I asked my kindergarten teacher about bowing in the class, because my son has a little verse that he's learned in school that mentions that word bowing in it. And they're supposed to make this gesture of bowing as part of this little song they sing. So I said, what are you teaching these kids about bowing? And he didn't really know what to say. He didn't have much to say. And I said, what I've learned this week is that in the founding of this country, there seems to have been a conscious choice when the institution of the presidency was created that Americans were not going to bow or curtsy to the president like they did to the king or queen of England, because in America, everybody was equal. And so the kindergarten teacher said, that's interesting. In this classroom, we have a lot of kings and queens. So they bow to each other, I guess. So that was very—it was very touching for me to be in that candle ceremony. And now we're getting close to the solstice, and this time of year is often a time of year that people bring out the lights. It's a dark time of year, and they bring out lights and they light their houses. Some people, and they light candles for different reasons, and partly, you know, the light is to create light in dark situation. It's to dispel the darkness, and then it has a lot of symbolic meaning. The burning of candles of light, the darkest time of the year. And Buddhism also has a lot of symbolic value in light, the symbols of light and luminosity. The Buddha once said, the mind is luminous except for the defilements that visit it, that come and visit. So if somehow in its essence and its true nature or something, the mind is luminous, it's light. But it's color, it's kind of clouded over and colored by greed and hate and ambition and fear. And so the mind itself has a quality of light. The enlightenment in Buddhism the experience of awakening, has a long history of being depicted in the form of a moon, a full moon. And partly it's because I think the full moon and the new moon were times when the Buddhist community would gather. So like gathering like this in the dark, they'd gather in the evening at night, they'd be sitting under the full moon, and they would do various communal practices, reminding themselves of their communal life together, asking for forgiveness of each other at that time, every fortnight, you know, asking for forgiveness for how it transgressed in our community. And then they'd recite the rules, the monastic rules that they would live by. The lay people would recite the five precepts. And the full moon then, so they're sitting there in the full moon, you know, for 2,500 years. The full moon itself has become a very powerful symbol of enlightenment, the fullness of it, the purity of it. And one of the things that I'm touched by is that, it's kind of a silly little notion, I suppose, but from our perspective, the human perspective on the earth, we talk about the moon being full, new, quarter moon, sliver moon, I don't know, different ways of talking about the moon. But for the, from the moon's perspective, it's always full. And our enlightenment, the luminosity of our hearts, our minds, the purity of it, is always there. But it's the various things that cover it and cause shadows on it. And so we don't see it fully for what it is. As Buddhism developed in Asia, Japanese love to make use the symbolism of the moon, the full moon. And there's a beautiful image of the full moon reflected in the dewdrop. The dewdrop being one of the most ephemeral things existing on the earth. It evaporates as soon as the sun comes out. But that even something as small as a dewdrop, when the moon is out, it's reflected in that dewdrop. That somehow the sacred or the quality of luminous mind, of awakening or freedom, of reality, is found in even something as ephemeral as a dewdrop. Every rocks and trees, everything, the full awakening, the freedom, is found even in the dewdrop. And there's a book called The Moon in the Dewdrop, a collection of essays by Zen Master Dogen. And when they were going to come out with a sequel to that book a few years ago, I recommended that they title the second book Earth in a Teardrop. And I thought that was a wonderful balance of the two different positions. The moon in the dewdrop and the earth in a teardrop. Because both are true. You know, the suffering of the earth, this world we live in, can be reflected in our teardrops. We cry and we see what happens. And it's also true at the same time that there's this luminous sacredness, stillness, peacefulness that's available, that's here. And the juxtaposition is often quite stark in this life we live. So stark that some spiritual people talk about the battle of light and dark. They use very clearly the symbolism of black and white, light and dark, to reflect the great differences of the suffering of the world, the evil and violence of the world. And Buddhism does the same way. It talks about the experience of awakening, the luminous mind, the power of mindfulness, as being like a light that goes on in a dark room. And that we often live in the dark. And I think anybody who practices mindfulness can get some sense of when they've been living in the dark and when they're starting to wake up and be mindful. It doesn't take much to realize how much of the time of the day we might go through and we weren't really present, we weren't really, really aware of what was going on. And then to wake up to that, and to see it, and then to appreciate the wakefulness, appreciate the mind that sees and is awake, is to see the power of wakefulness and the power of being blind and asleep and acting from that point of view. One of the fascinating things about wakefulness, we spend a long time maybe being asleep, maybe minutes in meditation, hours, days, or whatever, is what happens in that first moment. The very first moment when the light of awareness, the light is turned on, and you see what's been going on. You see that you've been asleep. You see you've been caught up in some reactivity. That very first moment is a moment of of mindfulness, a moment of pure mindfulness. What often happens on the heels of it, so close that we often don't see it as being separate, for often enough, is our judgments about what that meant, that we were lost. Judgments about what it meant that we were caught up. And so it's not so uncommon for us to then to feel, oh, what a terrible person I am. Oh, I blew that. Oh, that's terrible. I was lost. You know, I'm not a good person, not a good Buddhist or whatever. Or I better shape up here. You know, I haven't been doing it right. I got to shape up. I got to be mindful. I got to kind of gear myself up and steel myself or pounce back on the breath if we're following the breath. And, you know, some kind of reaction happens very quickly. But one of the most interesting things here is that one reaction can be, oh, I'm not doing it. I'm not being mindful. I'm not being aware. And the irony of that is that the moment that you say, I wasn't aware, you had to have been aware enough to have been aware that you weren't there. You follow? And the moment you wake up and recognize I've been lost, at that moment you're mindful. At that moment you have all the mindfulness you need for that moment. And then it's in some way squashed by getting then caught up in the judgment and the reactivity of, oh, what that means. And this is pretty normal. It's part of what we have to work with and kind of face and be honest about and practice and see. And wake up to this very phenomenon I'm talking about. But there is, in that first moment, the first instant of waking up, of noticing, the first innocent moment of noticing before the judgments come in, there's a luminous quality of the mind. There's a clarity, there's a light has gone on. And it's possible over time, as the mind gets stronger and mindfulness gets stronger, to appreciate that moment, to see that moment when the light first goes on, and to celebrate it, to nurture it, to prompt it, to encourage it. And if you can appreciate it, even just so slightly, appreciate that's what's happened, oh, I'm awake. And let there be a little gap before the judgments and reactivity come in. And then rather than doing something with that awareness, invite your experience to come into your awareness. Like turn on the light and then let things come in. What comes to you? Some people who meditate have this idea that they have to, you know, the mind's gone away, and I'm going to bring my mind back. As if the mind can be moved around. Have you ever seen anybody move their mind? It's kind of a linguistic thing. We say the mind goes away and it comes back. We bring it back. You could easily talk about it in other ways. And one way is that the mind is aware, and then we invite experience to come back into the mind. The mind is shut down. Some aspect of the mind, the awareness, has been shut off, shut down. It's been cracked open. And now in that crack, we invite things to come back to it and fill it. So turning on the light in a dark room, what is that experience like of being mindful? One of the koans, one of the areas of exploration for people who do mindfulness, is not only to explore what you're mindful of, what your experience is, and see it more clearly, but in the times when your mindfulness is most strong or most clear, what's the quality of that mindfulness itself? When you're really there and giving full presence to your experience, what's that feeling of presence like? What's the light like when you turn it on? It's not that often that people turn the mirror back and appreciate the light of awareness itself. And often what you'll find is that light of awareness itself has a quality of peacefulness, has a quality of stillness, of silence, of contemplative, perhaps even kind of joy or ease, that can be a guiding light for how we live our lives. So light. The Buddha gave a sermon called the Fire Sermon. And I read a book once, or saw a book in a bookstore, of the best speeches of humankind. And I just looked through it a little bit, and there at the beginning was the Fire Sermon of the Buddha. And the way, if you read it someday, you can maybe imagine he was like a gospel preacher. Kind of. It was very forceful. If you read it in that style, you kind of maybe get the impact of it. But he goes and says, the world is on fire. The eyes are on fire. The ears are on fire. The nose is on fire. The tongue's on fire. The body's on fire. The mind's on fire. The world is on fire. Sight, things we see are on fire. Things we smell are on fire. Things we hear are on fire. Things we taste are on fire. Things we touch are on fire. The mind is aware of, thinks, is on fire. The whole world's on fire. If you can get weary, if you can get disenchanted, if you can get a little bit from that fire, then the fire of greed, the fire of hate, and delusion will begin to dissipate, and you'll start experiencing the feeling, the experience of liberation, of freedom. And we know, you know, it's easy enough to see, kind of, in some ways, that the fire of hate, the fire of lust, the fire of greed, the fire of fear for some people, has tremendous impact and power on this world that we live in. The Buddha said someplace, and if we're a world that's on fire, why don't we look for how to end the fire? But one of the interesting things here is that the image of fire then comes back in Buddhism to also be a word that's used for meditation. So the world's on fire with all these powers of greed, hate, and delusion. But then the meditator's mind, the word jhana, jhana means meditative absorption, when your meditation, you're really absorbed in your meditation, comes from the root to burn. Jayati, to burn. And here, the absorbed mind is on fire. Also, kind of a fire. The fire of the mind. But when the mind is on fire in deep meditative absorption, it's kind of like a candle. This is a classic image. A candle flame which is unflickering in the wind. There's no wind to flicker. So it's completely still. And you look at a flame that maybe there's no wind, and you can maybe can't see that it's moving, but it's, you know, it's very dynamic, very balanced, not moving or wavering. So the mind becomes, the mind itself in meditation becomes like a steady fire, maybe that's been turned down in some ways from the kind of wild, agitated forest fire that can sometimes be in our minds. And it's that when the fire of the mind has been steadied, calmed, centered, that then it becomes the vantage point from which to most realistically see the nature of our life itself, who we are, what this world is like, and what's going on kind of in the deep kind of recesses of our minds. In order to really see deeply into our minds, the mind itself has to be very still and very quiet. If the mind is agitated, they can't see itself very deeply. So to have this fire, to kind of adjust the fire, the flame of your mind, the luminous flame of your mind, to adjust it, to refine it so that it becomes an instrument that can see deeply into its own nature. In talking about light, there's a beautiful analogy, I suppose, that the Buddha gave. One of the very important precursors for the arising of the spiritual life, in this precursor, the Buddha said, this is like the dawn that appears before the sun arises. And here the sun is being, now another form of light symbolizes this kind of maturity of the spiritual life. And before the spiritual life matures, what heralds its appearance, the Buddha said, like the dawn heralds the appearance of the sun, is good spiritual friendships. Having good spiritual friends. Having other people we know who are also living values of the heart, of the luminous mind, of freedom, who are no longer motivated by greed, hate, and delusion. And I thought about that as I was coming here today, and it's another reason why I wanted to sit together with the candles. That there's something very wonderful and luminous about a community of people that meditate together. And I have tremendous appreciation for coming here every time I come, to be able to sit together with all of you in this opportunity. And what has happened here in Redwood City, now that we have this center, in the last year, I've kind of described it to people sometimes, that I feel like I'm so in awe of what's happened here. It's exceeded my expectations or my vision of what would happen. I feel like we have created this bright light in Redwood City that shines out of all this goodness and good intention and good community that we have. The dawn of spiritual maturity is having good spiritual friends. The Buddha was once asked it's by someone, I think it was Ananda, who said, "It seems to me that having good spiritual friendships is really important. I think it's probably at least half of the spiritual life." And the Buddha said, "No, it's the entire spiritual life. Spiritual friendships are that important. It lays the foundation of spiritual maturation." Another strand of what I was kind of thinking about coming today. Yesterday's talk, we touched briefly on the notion of Buddha nature. And then I had Dharma discussions today with some teacher friends of mine, Buddhist teachers. And one of the interesting controversies in Buddhism, because of the many different kind of Buddhist schools, it has to do with, in a sense, the nature of being a human being. What's our nature? And in the Mahayana Buddhism tradition, explicitly, but in the Theravada tradition in some corners of it, there's a notion of what could be called the Buddha nature. And the Buddha nature that we all have is a complicated theological thing. There's many different definitions of what it means. But one aspect of the Buddha nature is that there's something sacred or divine or special or enlightening, liberating force within us. Part of us partakes of Buddhahood. In maybe in Christian terms, we'd say partakes of the divine. And but it's a little bit problematic for Buddhists to say partakes to the divine or to the God, something like that. So what are Buddhists saying? So Buddhists say, so there's all these theologians in Buddhism that, or Buddhologians, who have different definitions of what's happening with Buddha nature. But how I understand Buddha nature teaching has to do with a very positive view of human nature. And that is that, in a sense, in our core, in our essence, in the luminous mind at their core, there's a self-healing momentum, or self-organizing momentum, or self-liberating momentum. There's a momentum, a force, moving us towards liberation, if we allow it. And a lot of practice then, spiritual practice, involves getting out of your own way, so that this Buddha nature, the self-organizing, self-healing aspect of the psyche, can have a chance to operate. So it's a very optimistic view about the nature of the human heart, the human nature. And an analogy sometimes I use, it's maybe not so good, but if you cut your finger, you have to do some work. You have to keep, you have to maybe clean the cut, you have to maybe put a Band-Aid on it, and then you're... you know, the body can heal itself. But you can't tell your body, you know, heal yourself very well. And you can't orchestrate what's going to happen there. It's a very complex little healing process. It's kind of a natural functioning of the mind that happens almost regardless of your will, of your conscious abilities to do something. In the same way with the inner life, the Buddha nature view is that if you create the right conditions, put the right Band-Aids on, clean the wounds a little bit, then that allows for the healing, the natural healing power of the psyche to operate. And it's not so comfortable to do that because, as you know, it can hurt quite a bit to try to heal, to clean your wounds. But you have to be there with, you know, and put a bandage over it. The other view that exists in Buddhism sometimes, it doesn't have such an optimistic view of human nature in that way. It's very optimistic in that it sees that we all have a potential of reaching enlightenment if we cultivate ourselves and develop ourselves and if we let go of the forces of greed, hate, and delusion. But letting go of greed, hate, and delusion in itself is not enough to get us to awakening. We have to also cultivate and do something And so there's much more emphasis on action and doing in the practice. But a nature practice emphasizes a little bit more relaxing and letting go into this process. The people, the more traditional view, doesn't have a kind of some idea of a self-organizing, self-liberating force within the psyche to fall back on. So it always has to do with your effort. You have to make the effort and effort and effort. Make enough effort, the right kind of effort, adjust the flame just right, then, you know, the experience of awakening can happen. For the second view, it has optimism of what possibility of enlightenment, but it doesn't have a very optimistic view of the nature of the human psyche in and of itself, except through our own effort, it's improved. So we had this discussion today, these Dharma discussions, these different Dharma teachers, and we highlighted these two different views that exist in Buddhism. And then the question was, which one's right? And one person pointed out that the different personalities and different people with different genes or I don't know what are predisposed to different camps, different views. And who's right? I don't know who's right. But I know I'm predisposed to the Buddha Nature School. But I don't know if that's good. But that's the case. But I do know that whether in either view, the people who practice, the people who engage in the practice of mindfulness, of honesty, of ethics, of compassion and love, are a bright light in a world of darkness. To the degree to which the world is dark, the places of the world is dark, the world needs people of light, people who bring goodness forth. And whether it's the goodness which is inherently there, or the goodness that we produce and create by acting on good intentions, it doesn't matter that much to me. As long as somehow we tap into that bright light and goodness that we're all capable of tapping into and touching. We celebrate light in the time of greatest darkness, partly to remind us that the darkness is always temporary and the light is coming, spring and summer. The moon is always full. There was a kind of dignity bestowed upon the kindergarten children as they walked that spiral with their candle. A sense of worthiness and value, being attended to and seen. And as you sit here in the light, as you sit each of you in your own light of your own heart, your capacity for mindfulness and awareness, can each of you be a light unto yourself? Where you offer yourself dignity, reverence, care, a sense of worthiness that you're worthy to be seen and appreciated. One of the last things the Buddha said before he died was, be a lamp unto yourselves. Turn your light on. Adjust the flame so it's not out of control. So it's a calm, steady burn that lights the room up, lights your heart up as clearly as possible. And then may all the goodness in your heart have time. May you give yourself the time to let the goodness in your heart be expressed in the world around you. my hope is that, I didn't bring enough candles for everybody, but my hope is that all these candles find homes tonight, and that they go home with someone. And when you feel like it's the right time, that you light your candle and remind yourself, the Buddha saying, be a light unto yourself. And since there's not enough candles for everybody, maybe you have your own candle you can light. So happy solstice, and may you find the light in the darkness. Thank you.